This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
The Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler, hang your cloak and a peg. Grab a stool and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. Carlos Cagina is my technical producer. Ryan White is the live stream producer. Please take a moment and check out the YouTube and Rumble channel Strange Planet. All right. So somewhere in the world, right now, there's an episode of The Twilight Zone playing. It remains one of the most cleverly crafted and iconic television shows of all time. Nicholas Parisi is standing by to give us a glimpse of the series and the man behind The Twilight Zone, Rod Serling. Serling was one of television's brightest, most literate pioneers and a true believer in the medium. He was known as the angry young man of Hollywood early on in his career, clashing with studio execs and sponsors in his quest to loosen the corporate grip of censorship. He battled to write freely on controversial topics, and he would maintain that outspokenness as an artist and a thinker throughout his career. He's most revered for having had the ability to produce works of drama that probed the human psyche in an imaginative and thoroughly unique way. His work demonstrated a deep love for humanity and a strong belief of a better tomorrow. Over the next 2 hours, we're going to explore the life and times of Rod Serling and his work, The Twilight Zone, Pre-Twilight Zone, and The Night Gallery, and more. Nicholas Parisi serves on the board of directors of the Rod Serling Memorial Foundation, a charitable organization dedicated to preserving and promoting Rod Serling's legacy. He's a former staff writer and editor for Good Times magazine in Long Island. He's also a musician and a vocalist. Back in 2010, his former band, Arioch, released a CD with the Serling-inspired title Between Light and Shadow on Retrospect Records. He lives in Ronkonkoma, New York, and he's the author of Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination, with a foreword by Rod Serling's daughter, Anne Serling. Nicholas is also presenting Serling Fest 2022, being held this August in Binghamton, New York. Nicholas, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great, Richard. How are you doing?
I'm well. Okay, so first of all, you help me out with the where are you living exactly?
It's Ronkonkoma.
Ronkonkoma.
Ronkonkoma, yes.
There you go.
Your instinct may be to say Ronkonkoma, but it's Ronkonkoma.
Ronkonkoma. All right. Yeah. Let's promote the Serling Fest 2022 right out of the gate, because this is great stuff you're doing. This is in Binghamton, New York. Give us the dates and the particulars.
It is. Thanks. And I appreciate that, because this is a big event for us. It's going to be held August 12th, 13th, and 14th in Binghamton, New York. And Binghamton, it was Rod Serling's hometown. This was where he grew up. Rod Serling was born in Syracuse, New York, which is about an hour north of Binghamton. But when he was just about a year and a half old, the family moved to Binghamton, and he spent the rest of his formative years in Binghamton, and he loved his hometown. It's just one of those things. He loved his hometown. He held a great nostalgia for his hometown, a great yearning to go back to his childhood in Binghamton. And it's something he carried with him for the rest of his life. So the Rod Serling Memorial Foundation is based in Binghamton. It was founded in Binghamton, and this is going to be our sixth Serling Fest. And it's going to be technically at three different places, but they're all very, very close together in Binghamton. But the main event is going to be on August 13th at the Forum Theater, the Broome County Forum Theater, all day long from 9 a.m. till 10 o'clock at night. And we do all sorts of things. We have screenings, we have trivia, we have raffle giveaways, we have a whole bunch of really great authors who are going to join us this year. Mark Zickery, author of The Twilight Zone Companion, will be with us. Anne Serling, of course, will be with us. Mark DeWizziak, who wrote Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone, will be with us. I'll be there. My book, Rod Serling, is Life, Work, and Imagination, you mentioned. So it's a gathering of probably the greatest gathering of Serling experts you're ever going to find in one place, all together for 3 days of nothing but tribute to Rod Serling and the Twilight Zone, but also things outside the Twilight Zone as well.
Not too many television writers have, you know, scholarly works written about them, but there have been a number of scholarly works written about Rod Serling, including yours. How did you become a Rod Serling scholar?
Well, quite unintendedly, I guess. Not purposely, that's for sure. I was like everybody else. I was a huge Twilight Zone fan when I was a kid. I watched it, you know, I was mesmerized by it from the time I was probably 9 or 10 years old. I just fell in love with the show. And I just became interested in learning more about what Rod Serling wrote outside of the Twilight Zone. So I became kind of a collector of information. I just wanted to gather as much information as I could about all the things Rod Serling wrote. And I have a kind of a completist mentality, you know, as a collector. I think most collectors are like that. If you collect something, you want to collect all of that thing. You know, if you collect, you know, comic books, you want to collect maybe all of the one character that you like the most. You want to be complete about it. So I did that with information. I wanted to compile the most complete list and archive, so to speak, mental archive of Rod Serling's career. And so that was the idea behind the book. And it just kind of went from there. It kind of jumped from that thinking into a book.
How was his character shaped growing up in Binghamton? I'm guessing, you know, he was born, what, 1925? So I'm guessing he listened to, you know, radio dramas and mysteries and The Shadow and all that. But were there any particular shows or any particular performers that really influenced Rod Serling?
Yeah, sure. Well, he was born Christmas Day, 1924, so almost 1925, and he grew up in what he would consider to be an idyllic time. I mean, he had an idyllic childhood. At least that's the way he looked at it. And he had an older brother, Robert. His older brother, Robert, was I believe 6 years older than him. And he and his brother loved the things that you think they would love. They loved radio shows, The Shadow for sure. Rod very quickly became a big fan of Arch Oboler and Norman Corwin. Those were the two that were big influences on him in terms of radio writers. But Rod pretty much, and he loved movies too, of course. He loved everything that you would imagine: comic books, the pulp magazines. He read. He was a reader. He loved King Kong. Was probably his favorite movie. So he was kind of a typical kid for the time, I think. And he just, he filled his mind with those things, with the radio shows and with pulp magazines and things like that. And then, you know, when he was 18 years old in high school in Binghamton, the day after high school graduation, he went off to war. And that is kind of the dividing line for Rod Serling. I mean, he had this idyllic childhood that he, you know, remembered so fondly. And it ended very, very abruptly by him joining the army and going off to war. And that shaped him in terms of he then idealized that time of innocence that he was always trying to recapture it from that moment forward.
How did the experience in the Second World War and maybe afterwards, how did that shape his, because he had this tremendous sense of justice. How did that shape that?
Well, for one thing, I do think that to some extent, Rod Serling was born with that sense of justice. I really do. I think that it was inherent in him somehow. It could have been genetic. He could have gotten it from his father, who was, by all accounts, a very, very smart man and a very, very moral man. So it certainly could have come from him. And it could also have come from the fact that he was a little guy. Rod Serling was a little guy. He was 5'5", maybe, you know, on a tall day, I like to say. He was 5'5". And he, not that I don't think there's ever been any stories about Rod being bullied. Rod was a very, very popular kid. He was a gregarious kid. He liked to talk. He had lots and lots of friends. He played baseball. So I don't think he was ever bullied, but he had a sense of what it would be like to be bullied. And, you know, I think that when he joined the army, you know, listen, he was Jewish. He wanted to fight the Nazis, you know, but I think he also had this idea that he was this, this country invading other countries. And, you know, we got to do something about this. And the experience shaped him just profoundly. I mean, it just, it affected everything that Rod Serling was from that point forward as a man, as a writer, as a thinker. He saw, you know, he saw some terrible, terrible things during the war. He saw some major combat. He came back from the war, certainly with PTSD. I mean, they didn't call it that at the time, but he certainly had it. He had nightmares. He had flashbacks. And he had to deal with that for the rest of his life. And it shaped everything he wrote from that point forward. He wrote lots and lots of war-related stories in and out of the Twilight Zone. And it changed his way of thinking, I think, in general.
At what point did he decide he was going to write for this new medium of television?
Well, he was there. Rod got into television right at the ground floor. You know, he was there at the very, very infancy of television, 1949, 1950. His first television show produced on a national program was in 1950. And so he started out as a radio writer. He started by writing radio scripts and by collecting rejection slips. I mean, he sent scripts to every radio series on the face of the earth, and they were all rejected over and over and over again. Even after he got an agent, they were still rejected over and over and over again. But he saw the writing on the wall when television came to be. When television came around, they were still, you know, there were those people who were snobs about television. There were people who thought, you know, this isn't going to last. It's a phase. It's, you know, they had, you know, kind of maybe some misplaced loyalty to radio. Like, radio is more cerebral. And Rod had none of that. Rod saw the writing on the wall. He said, this is the future. TV is where it's at. So he jumped on the TV bandwagon, so to speak, I mean, right away with both feet. So he just started sending, really, some of the same great scripts he wrote for radio, he would send to television series. And it took him a long time to break through, but he finally did. And then took off.
As a collector of all things Rod Serling, do you have any of his original scripts?
Well, not original, but yes, I do have copies of lots of them. There, you know, in researching the book, there are some archives that hold Rod Serling's collections of the original scripts, of his original radio scripts, original Twilight Zone scripts, original everything. And I was able to go through those archives in depth when I was doing research. So I do have lots of that stuff. And some of it is very, very interesting. You know, he was writing, you know, one misconception I think about Rod Serling is that The Twilight Zone was the first time that he wrote science fiction. And that is absolutely not the case. He wrote lots of science fiction before The Twilight Zone. Most of it didn't get produced, because television just wasn't doing science fiction really before The Twilight Zone, very little anyway. And so it wasn't, you know, it wasn't produced, but he did write. He always loved science fiction, loved it since he was a kid reading those magazines, Analog and Amazing Stories and things like that. So he wrote a lot of science fiction and fantasy, time travel stuff, and going all the way back to his early radio days, he was into that.
A Town Turns to Dust has some science fiction elements, wouldn't you say?
A Town Has Turned to Dust, if we're talking about the same script, that is the script that Rod wrote, that was supposed to be based on the Emmett Till
right.
kidnapping. Yeah, and they later remade it as a science fiction movie, made for cable movie, and which was a real good idea, I think, actually, to take that script and set it in a science fiction context. So they put some science fiction in it, but that came later, yeah.
But he, and we'll come back around to that, but he did try and sort of, sometimes he used science fiction, right, to disguise, to get it past the message, these controversial messages past the ad agencies and the censors and so forth. But we'll come back around to A Town Turns to Dust. Just sort of one more kind of, I don't know, philosophical question before we dive right into his career. And that is, when you talk to younger people, and maybe they only know of the Twilight Zone because of the reboot that came out a couple of years ago. And what do you tell them about Rod Serling? How do you explain to them why he's so important even today?
Wow, that's a really great question, Rich. Well, the first thing I would say is that you would be surprised at how many younger people do know the Twilight Zone, the original Twilight Zone. You know, they first of all, being the phrase Twilight Zone is just in our language. You know, you don't even have to ever seen an episode of the original series to know what the Twilight Zone means. You know, if you're in the Twilight Zone, you know it means something's off kilter, something is weird, something strange, something just doesn't make sense. So they know that. And if they know the Twilight Zone, then, you know, your work is half done for you because they know what the imagination of Rod Serling was all about, and they know what those shows are like, and they probably enjoy it. But when I tell, you know, forget about kids, when I tell anybody what's important about Rod Serling, it's his humanity. It's the humanity that he put into his work, into the scripts, whether they were science fiction, fantasy or not. It's the humanity that he put into those characters, into the messages. If the Twilight Zone was just a collection of twist endings that were shocking for the moment and then went away, we wouldn't be talking about it right now. We're only talking about it because Rod Serling made that show more than a collection of twist endings or spaceships or rockets or anything visual. It always had something deeper beneath the surface, and that's what's made it last for 60 years now.
So before Twilight Zone, there was Kraft Theater, there was Playhouse 90, there was the Steel Hour. What work from that period jumps out at you as maybe his finest?
Well, I think Requiem for a Heavyweight for Playhouse 90, it was the second episode of Playhouse 90, and that was almost certainly Rod's favorite piece of his own work. He was very, very proud of Requiem for a Heavyweight. I make the point in the book, I don't think I had to make this point really. Anybody who knows Rod Serling kind of is aware of this already, but Rod was his own toughest critic. Rod was his harshest critic. He never gave himself a break, and he would criticize his own work to the nth degree. But Requiem for Heavyweight was the one piece of work that he never said a bad word about Requiem for Heavyweight. That was something he really put his heart and soul into, and it was a triumph on all levels. And he was very, very proud of it. So, I mean, that one does jump out at me. That's as being the finest probably before the Twilight Zone, yeah.
He did a little boxing of his own, didn't he?
He sure did, yeah, in the Army during basic training. He was represented his unit, the 511th Parachute Infantry Regiment. And by all accounts, he won 16 or 17 bouts in a row. He was a lightweight. Or a featherweight, and in his 17th or 18th bout, he got demolished. He got killed. He broke his nose, and he was really just knocked for a loop. And he said, "All right, I think I'm done with this. I think I'm done with this." So that was it. But he always had a respect for boxing and for boxers. He had an affection for boxers in particular, because he just felt that these, you know, people who dedicate themselves to boxing, they are not prepared really to do anything else, and it's such a finite. You know, any athlete really, but boxers particularly have such a finite shelf life. You know, they can only do this for so long. And then when they're done, what do they do? Where do they go with their life? And that was Requiem for Heavyweight. That was the existential, you know, question about that show. Like, where does this guy go after he's done boxing? When they tell him, hey, you can't box anymore, what's he going to do with his life? And that Rod Serling was very sensitive to that question.
I saw an interview. And this is legendary. I think all Rod Serling fans talk about that interview he did with Mike Wallace, which was like 1958 or 59. It was just before he started the Twilight Zone, but he was alluding to this next series that he was going to do. And it was almost like he was looking forward to it as almost an opportunity to maybe relax a little bit, because he had been at war with the ad agencies and the sponsors and the studio execs for so long, he was just sick and tired of compromising himself, I guess. He wanted to write profound television dramas. So he was looking forward to the Twilight Zone in that capacity, but it didn't work out that way, did it? You know, it wasn't like he got a chance to relax.
I don't know if Rod could relax. I don't know if he had that in him. He was constantly working, constantly thinking, constantly on the move. He was just, I don't know if he ever relaxed other than when he got to, on his boat on Lake Cayuga, you know, and then in the summertime, you know, that was probably about it. But yeah, the Twilight Zone, well, from that perspective, he did get to relax to some extent because, yeah, the battles with the sponsors and the network executives pretty much was done. The Twilight Zone really did take him out of that realm. He didn't really have to fight with them anymore, because, you know, a lot has been made about the Twilight Zone being able to address these issues through allegory, through science fiction, through fantasy, and kind of slip the issues past the sponsors. And I think that's somewhat true. That is true. And Rod Serling himself said plenty of times that that's one of the reasons he did the Twilight Zone, was to, so he could get away with some of this stuff. But I think it also was just about the fact that the network and the sponsors weren't going to take a half hour filmed science fiction series as seriously as they would take a 90-minute straight drama. In other words, Rod could do something like The Monsters Who Do on Maple Street, which is as blatant a social commentary as you're ever going to get. And I don't think anybody could watch the show and not realize what Rod Serling is saying. I mean, it's not like a subterfuge. I mean, he said what he wanted to say in that show. But he didn't get into any trouble with that show, because it's like, you know, leave Rod alone. He's in his little sandbox. Nobody cares about that half hour science fiction show. It's for kids. You know, it's not a big deal. It's not at 10 o'clock at night. It's, you know, nobody cares. You know, and they kind of gave him the leeway because they just didn't give the amount of respect to science fiction, I think, that they would have given. They weren't watching it as closely as they would watch a Playhouse 90 and say, hey, Rod, you got to change that line, because it's going to, you know, work, you know, it's going to bother the sponsors south of the Mason-Dixon line. This is robots and aliens and spaceships, and it's, you know, it's just not going to be taken as seriously as that kind of stuff.
By design, I guess, then he chose. Yes. He chose that genre by design. Although occasionally he did break format, and we'll discuss that as well. Over five seasons, what, 150 plus episodes. And again, presenting Serling Fest 2022, being held this August in Binghamton, New York. How do we get more information, tickets, and so forth?
Thank you. Yeah, the website is SerlingFest2022.com. And there you can find the link to buy tickets. And you'll also find the schedule of the exact events that are going on and the locations and everything else. So it's www.SerlingFest2022.com. And you'll get everything there.
How did the Rod Serling Memorial Foundation come about?
Well, it started long before I became involved with it. It started in 1985, so about 10 years after Rod died. And it was started primarily by Rod Serling's his first mentor, Helen Foley, a teacher of his at Binghamton High School, who taught him public speaking. And Helen Foley was, they were good friends. She was his teacher, but they were friends, and they stayed friends for the rest of Rod's life, even after he left high school. And she was a fan. She was an unabashed fan. She took a lot of pride in Rod's career and his Rod's success. And she loved the guy and he loved her. And so in 1985, she and a bunch of other of local Binghamton people who knew Rod personally said, we want to do something that can ensure that this man's work is not forgotten. And they started the foundation. It was originally the Rod Serling Memorial, or the Rod Serling Committee, the Rod Serling Memorial Committee, and then it became the Rod Serling Memorial Foundation. And it's a 501c3 charity. It's completely, completely charity. It's none of us get paid for anything we do for the foundation. It is a labor of love for all of us. And I'm really happy to do it. And Serling Fest is our big event, big yearly fundraising event.
How many people are drawn to the Serling Fest typically?
Generally, I mean, we've had a couple hundred. It's not a huge event. If there's 200 to 300, that would probably be about right. I certainly hope we'll get more than that this year, but that's about where it's been. So I think one of the nice things I tell people about Serling Fest is that it's not, Comic-Con. You're not going to come and be swamped by a 15,000 people and have to wait on lines and not be able to meet people and stuff. You come to Serling Fest, you're going to be able to sit and talk to Ann Serling. You're going to be able to sit and talk to Mark Zickrey. You're going to be able to sit and talk to me and Mark Dowidziak and Tony Alvarella and all these people who have intimate knowledge of Rod Serling's work, and you're going to see things that you would not see otherwise. We screen very rare Rod appearances, interviews that you would never have seen before. We're going to end the Saturday night. We're going to end with a screening of 7 Days in May, feature film that Rod wrote. So you get to see it on the big screen. So it's just, it's a really, really great gathering of aficionados of Rod Serling.
So we were talking about his battles in the early days on Kraft Theater and Playhouse 90 and the Steel Hour with sponsors and ad agencies and the studio execs and the censors. And he would you would usually lose. I mean, he would fight the good fight. You know, I want that line in there. I want the show told this way. And he'd lose. And then he'd go and, I don't know, kind of gripe to the media about it. And I guess hence the title, The Angry Young Man of Hollywood. Did that end up costing him work? I mean, did he have that hard to work with label?
Incredibly, not really. No. That is an incredible kind of almost a contradiction, you would think, that he didn't get that label. He got the nickname Television's Angry Young Man, but he really did not have the reputation because for a couple of reasons. One is that people love to work with Rod Serling. In my research for my book, I spent 4 years going through all of Rod Serling's correspondence, letters he wrote, letters he received, all of this stuff, interviews with everybody. And it's impossible to find somebody that didn't get along with Rod Serling. He was a very personable guy. When you were working with him, he had tremendous respect for the people he worked with. So the producers, the other writers that he worked with, the directors, he had tremendous respect for these people. And so they had a real fondness for Rod Serling, and they enjoyed working with him. And I think that even the sponsors, you talk about, say, the people who ran the ad agencies, you know, it's people who would actually come and watch a rehearsal of a show. Well, Rod would bash the interference, but he would never bash them personally. They were still friends with, you know, he was friends with these guys. And he understood that they had a job to do. And he would say, listen, your job is to push a product. I get that. I understand that. My job is to tell a story. So let's work on this. So we both get to do our jobs here, you know. And he was, you know, so he was very, he was just so personable that he never really, had that. And it certainly didn't cost him work. You know, one thing Rod Serling did was, which was smart and which was, I guess, just kind of made sense, is that he didn't really start making a stink about some of these things until after he had a name for himself. You know, back in his early days, from 1950 to 1954 or so, you don't find Rod Serling, you know, bemoaning the sponsor interference much on you know, at all, much if at all. But after he hit with Patterns was the show that made him an overnight success. And that's literal. That's like hyperboles overnight. From it showed one night, the next morning he was a star. He was the most in-demand writer in television. And from that point forward, he said, you know what? There are some things I want to use this medium for and things I want to say, and I'm not going to shut up anymore. I'm going to say what I have on my mind and let the chips fall where they may.
Tell us about Patterns, that breakthrough series for him.
Patterns was a 1-hour script that Rod wrote for Kraft Theater. And it was the story of, it wasn't a controversial show really, but it was a story of a man from Cincinnati, and Rod Serling worked in Cincinnati. So this is somewhat autobiographical. It was a man from Cincinnati who gets a job with a big firm in New York City. So he's going from kind of the small pond to the big pond. And when he gets the job in New York City, he eventually realizes that he's really there to take the place of the current vice president, who was an older man, unwell, and is not performing up to, you know, his expectations, and he has to take this guy's job. And it's about the moral dilemma that this guy has been put into, because he likes this guy. He respects the guy. He has affection for this guy, and he doesn't want to push this guy out. But at the same time, he does want the job. He wants the job. He wants to move up the corporate ladder. His wife wants him to move up the corporate ladder. And so it's about the, you know, that moral dilemma that he has in dealing with a boss who is a slave driver, you know, and the tension between Fred Staples is the character's name, between Fred Staples and Walter Ramsey, the boss of the company, is just so well written. So well written. The dialogue between those two characters is so powerful and so cutting that when this show aired, and, you know, people would think it's hyperbole now, they think I'm exaggerating or something, but after the show aired, the next morning, the New York Times ran a review of this show and said it was the best thing they'd ever seen on television. In terms of writing, acting, production, direction, it was the high point of the medium to that point, period. So it got unbelievably rave reviews. And it, like I said, Rod Serling's, one of his famous lines is that the moment that show went off the air, my phone started ringing and it hasn't stopped since. And he said, 20 years later, you know, it hasn't stopped since, because that was it. I mean, as soon as that show hit, that was it. And the thing about TV back then, you know, this was live, you know, this was a live performance. So one of the amazing things about Patterns is just the fact that it went off without a hitch. I mean, it was just such a perfect show. It was live, and there is not a single flubbed line, not a single flubbed word. I mean, the direction is perfect. There's no boom mic hanging in the frame somewhere. There's nobody tripping on something. It was just a perfect performance all the way around. And when, you know, with live television back in those days, it was like the opening of a Broadway show. And, you know, just like a Broadway show can open, get terrible reviews and be gone the next day or within a week, a well-reviewed television show can set somebody up for a long time. And that's what this did for Rod Serling. It gave him those kind of reviews where now he was on top of the world, and he kind of took it from there.
A lot of people used television as a springboard to get into film. I mean, he did write, obviously, he wrote some great film scripts, but he stayed in television. Why didn't he take that leap? Did he love the medium so much?
I think that was definitely part of it. He was asked that question, you know, several times. And part of it was that, yeah, he did have an affection for television. It was where he grew up, so to speak, as a writer. You know, it was what he knew, and he was comfortable there. And not only was he comfortable there, but he believed in the power of television. He believed that a medium like this that can enter everybody's living room, and especially in those days, we're talking about when there was three networks or four maybe. And, you know, so you had 60 million people watching one show. He believed that if a medium had that much power to reach that many people at any given time, then it better be better than what it's been. It better educate people. And, you know, he wanted to entertain people always. He always believed in entertaining people. That was first and foremost. But again, he believed that if you had this power, you know, to use the Spider-Man line, with great power comes great responsibility. You know, he had a responsibility. He felt that television had a responsibility. So he stayed with it with the idea that I'm going to do everything I can to try to get this medium to grow up. And he did. He helped it to grow up tremendously.
Enjoying this conversation immensely with Nicholas Parisi and presenting Serling Fest 2022 in Binghamton, New York, coming up next month in August. And once again, the website for more information
is SerlingFest2022.com.
All right. Are you licensed to air like episodes from the series? Or
we have been in the past, but this year actually we're not going to be airing any episodes. We are, as I mentioned, going to be screening 7 days in May on Saturday, and we're going to be airing some rarer stuff outside of the Twilight Zone this year.
All right. Did Serling ever direct?
No, he never did. And sometimes you'll see online the producer, director, wrestler. No, he never directed anything. He said, I couldn't direct traffic.
You know, that was interesting. I mean, yeah. Because obviously he was a wordsmith and he loved to write. To take that leap of faith and to hand that over to somebody else, to a director, and not, I don't know, he just seemed so, when he's on camera, he seems so earnest. I just find that hard to believe that, you know, he would let that go. That's his baby.
Yeah, well, with the Twilight Zone, I think that he felt that he didn't let it go because he really was so involved with everything. He was so involved with the production, with the casting, with the score, the music, with the editing, everything. He didn't get behind the camera and direct, but he was involved with everything else you could possibly have. And I think he just, again, I think he knew his limitations, and he knew, you know, he was involved with hiring the directors. He would hire the right person and he would have some control over, you know, the way it came out from all these other aspects, but he never had the desire to actually direct.
When he was writing at Playhouse 90, did he work with Paddy Chayefsky?
He knew Paddy Chayefsky very well. They never worked together, no, but they were writing certainly right at the same time for the same shows. And yeah, they knew each other very well.
That's my favorite movie, Network. Of course, Paddy Chayefsky. And that came out, I guess, like the year after Serling died in 70, yeah. It came out in 76. I was just trying to imagine if those two had ever gotten together and worked together. I mean, on their own, they were magnificent, but can you imagine? It's like Tesla and Edison.
Yeah, well, I think the closest you would get actually is Rod did work with Reginald Rose on a script once. Rod never worked with another writer. He was always by himself. But one time he worked with Reginald Rose on a script called The Challenge. It was a pilot for series. Well, the series really was called The Challenge. And he and Reginald Rose got together and brainstormed a bunch of ideas for it, and they wrote the pilot script together. Rod ended up later saying that Reginald Rose probably wrote 98% of it, but that may have been a little bit of Rod's self-deprecating and not wanting to take credit for it. But that show is available. You can kind of find it. It was never aired. It was produced. It was never aired, and the show was not picked up, obviously. But that's the one time where he did really collaborate with another writer, and it just happened to be, you know, Reginald Burroughs, which is, I don't know, maybe a half a step below Patty Chayefsky, maybe, if that.
It never aired. I'm wondering if, like, Serling aficionados, Serling fans, did they, like, look for those unreleased gems the way, like, a Beatle fan looks for those rare unreleased tracks?
Well, I certainly did. Yeah. That was part of what spurred the book, was that I started looking for all of these things. I wanted to know what exists. You know, so much of Rod Serling's work, and not just Rod Serling's work, but early television is gone. I mean, it's lost. The shows that aired live, many of them were not captured. They were not filmed. They were not captured on kinescope. And if they were captured on kinescope, they were thrown away, you know, so a lot of them are gone. So one of the things that really spurred my book was a desire to catalog, all right, what exists, what doesn't exist, what is at some archive somewhere, what is at some music, you know, some television museum somewhere, and what can I actually get, like, on the black market, you know, for lack of a better term, you know? So I searched out for all of those things and got my hands on anything that exists. Yeah.
We talked about whether, you know, he directed. I want to talk about acting, because he once said every writer is a frustrated actor who rehearses his lines in the hidden audition of his skull, or something like that.
Close, yeah, something like that.
Was he a frustrated actor?
I don't think he was a frustrated actor, no. I think, again, I think that was another example of he knew his limitations. I think he would have loved to have been an actor. And he was a ham. I mean, he was a ham. He liked to perform. And he did perform when he was a kid. I mean, he performed. I have clippings of Rod Serling performing at the local Jewish center when he was 6 years old. You know, I mean, he performed in plays from the time he was 6 years old through high school. And after high school, he performed on radio shows. He acted, you know, he did radio acting. He acted in a lot of the shows that he wrote. But he never, again, he was 5 foot five. And that at that time, you know, Tom Cruise probably wouldn't have made it as a leading man. He had to have some height to you. He had to have some heft to you. So he knew he wasn't going to be a leading man. But he did like to be on camera. He really did. No matter what he said, he liked to be on camera. And so he did some acting after The Twilight Zone, other than just the introductions that he would do on The Twilight Zone.
Right. Is that why he inserted himself as the narrator on camera? Was that his decision, or did he want to do that?
He wanted to do it, yes. It was a kind of a long story, but the first season of The Twilight Zone, he's not on camera. He's off camera. He does the introductions off camera. And the second season, they wanted to add an on-camera narrator. They thought it might, juice things up a little bit, maybe get the ratings up a little bit. So they were going to go get Orson Welles. And the long story short is Rod said, I'll do it. And they let Rod do it. and again, it was his baby. So he really did. If he said he was going to do it, they were going to let him do it. And, you know, the rest is history. He was who could be better at introducing Twilight Zone episodes? You know, nobody.
All right, back to more of our conversation. Nicholas Parisi talking about Rod Serling, his life, his work, his imagination, The Twilight Zone. Stay with us. Nicholas Parisi is here with us for the full 2 hours, and we're talking about Rod Serling, of course, and The Twilight Zone, and Serling Fest 2022 coming your way in Binghamton, New York in August. Serlingfest.com?
Serlingfest2022.com.
Serlingfest2022.com. All right. There's a well. You mentioned it, Orson Welles. I wasn't sure if that was an apocryphal story or not. That Orson Welles was originally slated to be the narrator. So they gave it some consideration.
Yes, I think the misconception on the Orson Welles things is what you said, is that he was never the original choice for narrator. There's been some discrepancies about that they originally wanted Orson Welles. What they originally, if you watch, you know, on the DVD collections, the Blu-ray collections, there is a demo version of the pilot episode, Where Is Everybody, that has a different announcer doing the the introduction and the Twilight Zone theme, you know, the beginning introduction. That was Jason, Van Voorhees. I forget his full name, but so there was a different announcer for that. And then Rod took over from him. And it was just after the first season was done that they decided, you know, maybe we should have somebody on camera. And the first name they thought of was Orson Welles. And they said, and Rod, actually, I had, you know, Rod was scheduled to fly to London to meet with Orson Welles. And I never was able to determine if he actually did follow through with that. But shortly afterward, he got the job, you know. So I think he kind of objected to a certain extent. Probably, and he probably had a good standing to object, because Orson Welles would have wanted too much money. I mean, and by too much money, I mean any money, because they were already trying to cut the budget in every way they possibly could. They couldn't afford to go hire Orson Welles to be the narrator. So Rod came at the right price. You know? So,
right.
So he got the job.
Well, we'll talk about the penny pinching in a moment. But if that meeting had taken place, I don't know, I'm imagining, you know, the Savoy Hotel or something. Boy, would I like to have been a fly on the wall for that conversation.
No doubt.
The meeting of those two minds. I'm sure Rod Serling must have been listening to the Mercury Theater back in 1938 with the War of the Worlds that night. Did he ever mention it?
I don't think he ever mentioned it, but yeah, I can't imagine he wasn't, yeah.
So the budgeting for the Twilight Zone, penny pinching, I guess, to say the least. They had to salvage props from elsewhere. Tell me about that.
Well, they reused props from themselves. I mean, so there, yeah, you'll see certain things throughout the series reused in various episodes, certain props. And they would get certain props from the MGM lot. You know, there would be they used the spaceship from Forbidden Planet. You know, I mean, they would do that when they had to. And again, I think one of the amazing things about the Twilight Zone is that, you know, nobody really cares about that. Nobody cares that the aliens looked crummy. You know, nobody cares that the spaceship, you saw the wires on it. You know, I think watching the Twilight Zone, you know, that just wasn't the focus. You know, that wasn't what was important. You know, it was nice. I mean, every now and then, listen, Twilight Zone did some really cutting edge stuff for the time, for 1959, 1960. When you're talking about things like Eye of the Beholder, you know, the direction of Eye of the Beholder, where you have to go through a half an hour without seeing anyone's face, you know, and the way they use shadows. And I mean, the directing job by Douglas Hayes in that episode is just tremendous. I think it was Douglas Hayes. I hope I get that right. But things like that, or The Howling Man, another one I think of, where it's just, they made the most of these, you know, unusual sets. You know, you would see things like an episode like The Obsolete Man, where they have a doorway that's about 25 feet tall, and Burgess Meredith goes through this doorway that's 25 feet tall, and he goes to a table that's like 25 feet long, to a podium that Fritz Weaver is standing behind that's about 25 feet tall. I mean, it was just this. They use the settings, they use the those kind of things to such great effect that, you know, they didn't need a million-dollar budget for special effects. You know, they got it done.
So five seasons.
Yes,
it was always in black and white, right? They never.
Oh yes, yeah.
Was there ever a consideration? I mean, for shooting in color?
Not during those five seasons. No. After the show ended, Rod wanted the Twilight Zone to continue. As much as he said he was burnt out and he was tired of it and everything else, I believe if somebody had come to him and said, "Yeah, we want to do another season of the show," he would have done it. And I do have some correspondence from him in the 60s saying, "Hey, what about this? What about an hour long Twilight Zone show in color? You know, why can't we do this?" And he wanted to bring it back. And he would have, if he had brought it back, it would have been in color. It would have been akin to Night Gallery.
They didn't. Was it originally a 30 and it moved to an hour, or was it an hour and they moved it to a 30?
No, it was originally a 30. It was a 30 for three seasons. And then it came back mid season the next season at an hour length. They did 18 one-hour episodes, and then it came back for a full season of half-hour shows for a fifth season.
So was the feeling then that the hour-long just didn't work?
Pretty much, yeah. The hour-long are pretty universally seen as not as good as the half-hour shows. And I think Rod wanted the show to be an hour-long to begin with. It was originally proposed as an hour-long show, and it took some doing to get him to agree to make it a half an hour. And so he never quite got that idea out of his head. So when they proposed to do it an hour in the fourth season, he was all for it. It wasn't like it was against his will. He wanted to do it as an hour, and it just didn't quite go the way he wanted it to go. And so he didn't object when they said, let's go back to a half hour. He knew that that was a better format for the show.
And how were the ratings, like from the season one right through to the end?
They were never great, but they were never terrible. They were always just kind of borderline and enough to get the show renewed. Occasionally, it had some episodes that were very highly rated, had some good promotion behind certain episodes and everything. So occasionally the ratings would spike, but they were never great. But they were good enough to renew, and it also had the prestige, and it had Rod Serling, and he really was the biggest name as far as writers go in television at the time. So they were willing to go with the show when it was decent ratings and had some prestige to it. They were willing to keep it going.
The theme song. We have to talk about the theme song. And those, you know, do, 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 do. You need three notes. It's worldwide. It's one of the great brands, dare I say, in the history of marketing, you know, like right up there with Coca-Cola or I don't know, CNN once upon a time. It's become such a touchstone, but they never used that in the first season, did they? Did that come in later?
That didn't come in until the fourth season, actually.
The fourth season.
Well, the fourth season, you know, I should check myself because I'm thinking the music and the actual visual. The visual of the door and the eyeball and the window and everything, that was fourth season. That came in the fourth season, and that was with the doo-doo-doo-doo theme song. But the doo-doo-doo may have actually also been in the third season. They just changed the visual. So I think it was the third season, actually. But the original, the first two seasons, certainly the first season, was the much more dramatic, so to speak, and ethereal, much more ethereal music with there is a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. And you kind of see the gauzy filter going across the screen. His dimension is vast as space and his time is infinity. So that was the original, yeah. But the doo-doo-doo-doo is the one that's stuck in everybody's brain and stuck in the popular culture forever. You just say those, like you said, four notes and you know exactly what you're talking about.
Do we know the origin of that song, who wrote it and how it came out, how it came out?
It was Bernard Herrmann, I believe. Marius Constant and Bernard Herrmann were the two main ones who wrote the two themes for the Twilight Zone. And I believe that one was Bernard Herrmann. And I don't know the story behind how he actually came up with that. But it was a stroke of genius, apparently, because, it's just immediately recognizable.
Yeah, what I want to know is the estate still receiving royalties for that?
For the song? For the theme? Yeah. That I don't know. I mean, I'm sure it was, a work for hire, as they say, So he likely didn't get full ownership of the music. I'm sure about that. But hopefully he got a little something. Yeah, I'm hoping he got a little something out of it.
All right. We are approaching the top of the hour, and we'll get ready, settle in for hour two. Nicholas Parisi, my guest. We're talking about the life and work and imagination of Rod Serling. Don't forget, Serling Fest 2022 coming to Binghamton, New York in August. SerlingFest2022.com, the website. All right, hold tight. We'll be back with more right after these.
Where there's smoke, there's The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio.
Thanks for inviting me into your home, your long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed basement with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker. Your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Carlos Cagina is our technical producer. Ryan White is our live stream producer. Please check out the YouTube and Rumble channels, Strange Planet. Nicholas Parisi is with us, and we are celebrating the legacy of Rod Serling. And Nicholas serves on the board of directors for the Rod Serling Memorial Foundation, a charitable organization dedicated to preserving and promoting Rod's legacy. He's a former staff writer, editor for Good Times Magazine in Long Island, and again, the author of Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination, with a foreword by Rod's daughter, Anne Serling. So, how did you get to meet Anne?
I first met Anne when she was doing a reading for her book, As I Knew Him, My Dad, Rod Serling. And she was doing an appearance for that. And I was working on my book at the time. And I had written an outline of my book, and a pretty detailed outline of my book. And I brought it to her. I met her and her husband, and I brought it to her and I said, hey, this is what I'm working on, and I'd love to get your opinion on it. And I gave it to her. And she called me the next day and said, this is wonderful. This is tremendous. I hope you do this. Please do this. Please finish this. It's exactly what's needed. Because again, I the one thing about my book is that it's the first book that covers Rod Serling's entire career from show number one to show number end, you know, and it covers them in a way that other books have not covered them, in a show by show, series by series basis. So I think she was very, you know, intrigued by the idea that there would finally be a record, you know, an official record of here's Rod Serling's body of work. Bam, that's it. You know, this is it. So she encouraged me, and she was instrumental in just, I mean, when you get the endorsement of the man's daughter, you're gonna do what she says, you know. So I went and finished the book, you know. So, and she was kind enough to offer to write the foreword for me. So, and we've been friends ever since. And that's and I always have to give credit to her book, because her book, As I Knew Him, My Dad, Rod Serling, is just a beautiful memoir. It's the book that if you feel like there's any part of Rod Serling that you don't know about, get her book, you know, get her book instead of mine, you know, and read that, because you'll get a picture of the man that you had not had before, of the father, the human being, you know, in her book. It's really a tremendous piece of work.
Well, I've not read it, but was he like an attentive dad? Because it seemed to be so wrapped up in his work. I imagine him as just like a workaholic. Was he an attentive dad?
Yeah, I think he was cloned. At some point he was cloned, because there had to be two or three Rod Serlings running around at some point, because I don't know how he was able to accomplish all the things that he did. But seriously, the amazing thing about Anne's recollections and Anne's book is the fact that, yes, he wasn't necessarily, let's put it this way. She says that she and her sister Jody never felt like they were without dad. They always felt that he was there, and he was approachable. You know, he had his office, you know, on the grounds. He had his office next to the pool, you know, at the house. And when they would come to New York, when they would come to Ithaca, and they had their lake house, you know, he would be working on the boat. He dictated. So he would be dictating on the boat, but he was there, you know. So they always felt that he was approachable and accessible. So no matter how much work he was doing, and it was a tremendous amount of work that he did. So that is the one amazing thing that you'll get from her book, is how was he able to do this? I'm not real sure.
So if I'm remembering correctly, he wrote 92 out of the 156 episodes over five seasons. I mean, there's prolific, correct, and then there's like Rod Serling. How did he work? Do you have a sense of how he wrote and his working habits?
Yeah, well, the first thing, like I said, is that very unusual for a writer. He dictated all of his scripts. He dictated everything. He started out like everybody does. He started out by typing in the 1950 to say 1954. About, he would type just like, you know, two fingers peck, hunt and peck, you know. But right around 1955, he started to dictate his scripts, because he felt that his mind was working too fast for his fingers, and he couldn't type fast enough, and he wanted to just get it out. So he started to dictate, and his process was, he would dictate the script pretty much straight through, give it to his secretary to type up. Then she would give him back the printed copy, and then he would go through it and line edit it. He would go back and, you know, he'd go and make notes, and then he would dictate the edits. So he would dictate Marge, you know, his secretary's name is Marge, page three here. Well, let's take it from here. And he would dictate the changes, you know, and he would go through it, and then she would give him the next draft, and that would usually probably be it. So, and he would work generally, you know, morning until lunchtime, take that long lunch break, and then work a couple hours after lunch, and that was pretty much it. Or during Twilight Zone days, he would be, you know, he'd work in the morning, then go to the studio, and he'd be at the studio, you know, for a, you know, till nighttime, and then come home afterward, you know. So he would put the Twilight Zone to bed every day, you know. But yeah, so he worked and worked and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. It's amazing the amount of stuff that he wrote in a short lifetime.
How did he write dialogue so well? I mean, I met Richard Matheson Jr. I interviewed him, and his dad, you know, great writer as well. One of the core four, as we'll discuss, but yeah. And he talked about, you know, to be a great writer of dialogue, you have to be a great listener.
Yeah.
How did Rod master writing dialogue?
I think that is the essence right there. You have to be a listener. And Rod Serling was, you know, I mentioned before that he was a very personable guy, and he got along with pretty much everybody, and he had a lot of friends. And I think one of the things that endeared Rod Serling to people was that he was interested in people. He really, if you talk, I mean, I was 5 years old when the man died, so I never met Rod Serling. I wish I could have met Rod Serling. I feel like I met Rod Serling sometimes, but if you listen to the people who knew Rod Serling or took his classes, because he taught for a long time, or just interacted with him, they would say that, you know, when you talk to Rod Serling, he looked you in the eye and he listened to what you said. And how amazing that, you know, he was never the Hollywood, you know, the Hollywood personality. Oh yeah, looking at his watch and saying, "Hey, nice to meet you. I got to get out of here." If you want something to talk to Rod Serling about, he would sit there and listen to you. So yes, he listened to the way people spoke, and he translated that into his work. And he had a great ear for dialogue. It was certainly his biggest strength as a writer.
Right. Would he also script out the stage direction or the?
Often, yeah. Often he would. Yes. In the Twilight Zone, certainly. He would script out the camera angles and things like that, close up, for, you know, medium shot, that kind of stuff. He would script that out, and pretty much, yeah, pretty much the same throughout his career. I don't think he ever really strayed away from that. I mean, he might have cut down on it a little bit later in his career, but not much. He would include that stuff.
Was he always a chain smoker?
Yeah, I think probably from the time he joined the Army. Yeah, I don't know if he smoked before that. He probably did, but I think the Army was where it really kicked in. And who knows how much he smoked? It was just, yeah, it was constant.
So we mentioned Richard Matheson. So there was what you call the core four group of writers: Serling, who wrote the bulk 92 out of 156 episode. We mentioned Richard Matheson. Who were the other in the core four?
Charles Beaumont would be the next one for sure, and George Clayton Johnson is the one that I would include in that four. George Clayton Johnson wrote Kick the Can, A Game of Pool, Nothing in the Dark with Robert Redford. He wrote some real classic episodes, George Clayton Johnson. I think Earl Hamner Jr. wrote more episodes than George Clayton Johnson, but George Clayton Johnson wrote better episodes by far. I mean, not to bag on Earl Hamner, but he was not quite the right writer for the Twilight Zone. His episodes are pretty forgettable. But those were the four. And I wish I knew the numbers on what each of them wrote. But between Rod and those three writers, so in those four, I believe they wrote, I think it was like 130 out of the 156. So I think there were only like 26 episodes written by other people than those four writers.
So, as an expert on Rod Serling, if you didn't know who wrote what episode, and you didn't look at the end credits, would you be able to tell? Oh, that's a Charles Beaumont, or that's a George Clayton Johnson, or no, that's a Serling.
Yes, I can certainly tell. If I am trying to think about, well, I'll tell you one. I actually did get fooled by one. Not too long. How long ago would it be? Probably about maybe 15 years ago. I was watching, and one of my favorite episodes, probably top 20, is an episode called, it's an underrated episode called The Trouble with Templeton. It's an episode about an aging actor who wants to go back in time to when he was younger and his glory days on the stage. And he goes back in time and his friends realize that he's come back in time, including his girlfriend. And they push him out. They say, you don't belong here. You need to go back to your own time. And the girl, and there's a scene in this episode that is just so beautiful where the woman, his girlfriend, has to play this part. She has to play the act. She has to act like she doesn't want him there because she knows it's better for him to be in the present. He shouldn't be in the past. And she pushes him out. And the moment he leaves, you see the emotion just come over her face. Like, what did I had to do something I didn't want to do. And when I watched that episode like 15 years ago, I thought it was Serling. I thought for sure it was Serling. And it turned out it was a man named E. Jack Newman. It was the only episode he ever wrote for the show. And I was shocked when I said, oh my God, I can't believe that wasn't a Serling. But one thing you will find, I think, is that E. Jack Newman in that episode, and there were a couple of times with George Clayton Johnson where I think that George Clayton Johnson was emulating Rod Serling just to a certain extent. So I think that in his episodes, there are some times where I feel like it's an extension of Rod Serling. You know, he kind of emulated him a little bit. But Beaumont and Matheson, they have very, very distinctive styles. You know, they stood out like a sore thumb.
And who decided on the core four? Was it the producers? Was it, did Serling have input?
It was mainly Serling and Chuck Beaumont. Chuck Beaumont Buck Houghton. Buck Houghton was the producer for the first three seasons of The Twilight Zone. And Serling and Buck Houghton were a great team. They really worked well together, and they had a real similar vision for the show. And so Rod met Beaumont and Matheson right off the bat when he screened the pilot, and they were recommended to him by Ray Bradbury. Ray Bradbury recommended these guys and along with George Clayton Johnson. And so they were at the screening of the pilot, and they kind of, you know, they met Serling and Rod invited them to submit their scripts. And I think it was just serendipity. It was just what an amazing bolt of luck, because they were so perfect. They were just perfect for the show. And, you know, and Rod just accepted their scripts, never edited them, never changed a word. I mean, he just took them exactly as they were and aired them. I mean, that was how well they worked together.
He never rewrote. Did he have that power? Could he have?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Rod Serling, I mean, he owned half the show. You know, he owned half the interest in the films. And like I said, he was the executive producer. He was, you know, so he had the power to do pretty much anything. And, you know, Charles Beaumont wrote a very famous article right at the beginning of the series for the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction about how when he gave his first script to Serling, it was a script called Perchance to Dream. Great, great episode about a man who thinks he's having a recurring nightmare, and he has a heart condition, and he thinks he's going to die in his sleep because he can't handle this nightmare. And he says, when I gave this script to Serling, I figured, all right, it's going to be chopped up. It's going to be edited. You know, I understand this is television. And you know, even though Rod told me, you know, don't worry about the little old lady in Dubuque. She'll get it. She'll understand it. Don't worry about it. Just write for yourself. Write it the way you want it to be. And Charles Beaumont said, when it aired, I was amazed that not a word had been changed, not a line. He was amazed. And so that kind of thing endeared writers to Rod Serling, because they knew this guy's going to respect my work. And if he was going to change something, he'd call me and say, hey, Chuck, you know, maybe we should work on this or something. He wasn't just going to take a pencil and change a line, you know. So, yeah, that was, you know, so most of the time, Beaumont and Matheson, their scripts were aired untouched.
True or false? They accepted scripts from viewers.
True and false. At the very beginning, Rod had this brilliant idea that, yeah, we'll open up floodgates. Let viewers send in their scripts, send in their ideas, and see what comes in. And he said, you know, they got like 500 scripts, and like one of them was even remotely passable. So he stopped that practice pretty much right away. So none of those scripts ever aired, and yeah, he regretted that decision pretty quick.
Yeah, give those to the Outer Limits. Yeah. Was there kind of a friendly competition with similar shows?
Well, Outer Limits came after The Twilight Zone. So there wasn't. I do know that Serling enjoyed The Outer Limits. He enjoyed Joseph Staranko was the main writer and creator of The Outer Limits, and he admired him. He thought he did good work and everything. But no, so there was never really any competition or anything. One Step Beyond actually came before The Twilight Zone. So that had a little bit of an overlap with The Twilight Zone. But again, Twilight Zone was not, it was unique. It wasn't either of those shows. You know, it was its own thing, really.
Charles Beaumont, He was the one that died quite young. He looked, he was only, I don't know, maybe 40, but he looked maybe twice that age. What happened to Charles Beaumont?
He was stricken with a rare brain disease, a brain disorder that is akin to Alzheimer's disease, akin to early onset Alzheimer's disease. And he was like 35, I believe, when he contracted it. And yeah, he aged incredibly quick to the point where when he died, yeah, he looked like he was 70 years old. And when he first started experiencing the symptoms of it, people thought he was a drunk. You know, people thought that he was they thought he was a drinker because he appeared drunk. He would slur his words. He couldn't quite think as clearly as he used to. And several of the Twilight Zone scripts that were credited to Charles Beaumont later in the show were not written by Charles Beaumont. He would farm out his work because he just couldn't handle it anymore. He couldn't do it. He had ideas, and maybe it was based on his short story, but other people like John Tomerlin would write his scripts and ghostwrite them. And they did it out of friendship to him. They didn't get credit. They got paid, but they didn't get credit. And they did it because they knew what he was going through and they wanted to help. And he had so many assigned writing assignments that he just couldn't handle them. So yeah, it's a tragic, tragic story. Charles Beaumont was a brilliant writer. I mean, just a brilliant writer. He wrote novels. He wrote short stories. He wrote some of the greatest Twilight Zone episodes. The Howling Man is one of my favorites. Shadow Play is another of my favorites, both Charles Beaumont stories. And he died way, way, way too young.
I'm wondering what it was like on the set. I was on YouTube recently and I saw Clint Howard, Ron Howard's brother, reminiscing about life on the Andy Griffith Show, Andy of Mayberry, it was like such a family on screen and off screen, and they had all of these home movies, behind the scenes. Was there anything comparable like that on the Twilight Zone set?
I don't think so, and you could imagine why, because there weren't any continuing characters on the Twilight Zone, so it wasn't like they had a chance to really bond over the course of a season or whatever. But Rod Serling and Charles Beaumont certainly had that kind of friendship. And I keep saying Charles Beaumont, I mean Buck Houghton. Rod Serling and Buck Houghton had that kind of relationship. They were close friends and everything. And so there was that. And with the other writers, yeah, I should say Charles Beaumont, because they were all very good friends. Charles Beaumont, Richard Matheson, and Serling, and George Clayton Johnson, they were all very close. So that kind of thing. But there was, no continuing characters that could kind of develop that kind of relationship.
Right. But did Anne Serling spend any time on the set?
I believe she talks about one time being on the set when she was very young. Anne was born in, I'm going to probably date her. Let's put it this way. I think she was only like 5 years old when the show was on. So she was very young. And she remembers being on the set and just remembering like a stairway that went to nowhere and thinking that was so weird, like where these stairs go and it just ends, like that kind of thing. But no, nothing, no real stories about like antics on the set or anything like that.
So we think of the Twilight Zone primarily as science fiction and fantasy, but occasionally the show would break format. There's an episode with Carol Burnett and Jesse White, who I remember is he's the original Maytag repairman, but that's not fair. He did so much more than that. But as a kid, I remember Jesse White as the Maytag repairman. And that was just an out-and-out comedy.
They actually did several comedies. And the one of the big ironies of Rod Serling's life, actually, or as a writer, anyway, his writing life, is that Rod Serling loved comedy. And, you think of Rod Serling as being this dour, scary kind of guy and everything. Rod Serling was a cut-up. Rod Serling loved comedy. He did impressions. He was a student of comedy. He would go watch, Milton Berle or watch Red Skelton and just to absorb it, And so he always wanted to write comedy. It never quite came through, certainly not in the Twilight Zone. The episode with Carol Burnett, I don't particularly like that one, but it's a memorable one for her, I think. Because she's in it, I mean. And, so there was that one. There was, there's a few other comedies that, mainly I'm trying to think if anybody else wrote a comedy. I think mainly was just Rod, like an episode like Mr. Beavis is the kind of the companion piece to Cavender is Coming is the episode with Carol Burnett. Mr. Beavis is about a guy who has a guardian angel. He's kind of a, weird kind of, a goofball kind of guy. And he's always getting into trouble at work because he's just, he's a goofball, that kind of thing. And that was that was a kind of lighthearted comedy. And I like that one better than Cavender, actually. And, you know, there's a couple others. Showdown with Rance McGrew about a Western guy acts in a Western, and Jesse James comes back from the dead to tell him that he's given him a bad name because they're portraying all these characters in the wrong way and, you know, wants to like rewrite the show. Because, you know, I thought there's some laughs in that one. But Rod's comedies never, you know, they never quite made it, and at least as well as the other ones did, obviously.
Well, they say that's the hardest thing to do, right? Is comedy.
Yeah.
All right. Another time out awaits. Nicholas Parisi stays with us as we continue to pay tribute to the legacy of Rod Serling. Don't go away. 156 episodes, 5 seasons. What was the shooting schedule like for The Twilight Zone?
They shot most episodes in 3 days. Yeah. I mean, if they got a rehearsal on the first day, maybe, and then 2 days more. I mean, so it was, each episode was done pretty much three days.
Wow. Did they do a table read?
I don't know. I think they probably occasionally did. Yeah. I think probably they did a table read more often than they did a full blown rehearsal, I would think, just because of the time constraints, I would think. But yeah, but I don't know that for sure.
And was it like a one camera shoot and they would block it out, or was it like three cameras, or?
There were multiple cameras, but I couldn't tell you the specifics. That's something I did not get into, the technical stuff about the production of the show.
So we were talking about Cavender is Calling and some of the other episodes that broke with the format. There's another episode that sort of broke the format, The Silence, because there's no elements of supernatural or sci-fi at all. It's just a drama, almost like a psychological thriller even. So tell me about The Silence for those who haven't seen it. You write about it a lot in your book.
Yeah, I was going to say, I love The Silence, and I did not intend this. This was not a purposeful thing, but when I was writing my book, I found that I wrote more about The Silence than I did about any other Twilight Zone episode. And it was just because I found that I had more to say about it for whatever reason. And The Silence is somewhat polarizing because, as you said, it doesn't have any science fiction or supernatural aspect to it. And some people, you know, fellow Twilight Zone fans I know, don't like it for that reason. They think, you know, it could have been an episode of Alfred Hitchcock. And so why, you know, it's not really a Twilight Zone. So, but I don't see it that way. I just see it as a great piece of TV. I don't really care. It was a Twilight Zone. It was aired on the Twilight Zone. So for me, it's a great piece of TV and it's a Twilight Zone. So it's a great Twilight Zone. I don't, you know, really care if it was, you know, in the realm of something else. But The Silence is, again, yeah, for those who don't know, it's about a boor, you know, set in a gentleman's club. You know, it's a gentleman's club, all wealthy, to-do people. And this one particular member of the club just can't shut up. I mean, he just comes to the club and just yaps and yaps and yaps. And there's one character that really just can't stand it anymore. The rest of the people who are there kind of deal with it, and they deal with it. But this guy just can't handle it. And he finally bets the man $500,000 that he can't stay quiet for a year. And the bet is that to prove that he's, you know, going to be quiet for a year, they're going to put him in a booth where they can observe him at every moment of the day. He'll be there. He'll have all everything he needs, like food and water and TV, you know, books and whatever else he needs, but he can't speak. And the episode builds the tension, you know, can this guy make it through the year? And as the time goes on, the man who made the bet with him is, first, he's pleading with him to cut the bet. I'll give you $15,000 if you get out now. Just we'll cut it now. We'll call it even. And the guy won't take the bait. And then he finally starts trying to bait the guy into saying something by, you know, spreading rumors about his wife. Hey, I saw your wife out, but then, you know, and seeing, hoping that will do it, and that won't do it. And he finally makes it through the year without speaking, and he comes out to collect. And it turns out the guy who made the bet never had the money. He was a member of the club, but he had used up his fortune years and years ago. He was destitute. He had no money and he couldn't pay the guy. And then that's the first twist. And this is one of a couple episodes that have kind of a double twist. The second twist is that the reason this guy was able to do the year without speaking is that before he went in there, he had surgery done and he has vocal cords cut. And he shows you the scar on his neck where he had the vocal cords cut. So it's, what I found, and the reason I wrote so much about it in the book, was that it's such a brilliant piece of writing. I think I've been using that word brilliant a lot, but it's kind of the best word for this. It's such an amazing piece of writing on Serling's point in the fact that in 30 minutes, and not even 30 minutes because commercials, 24 minutes, mm-hmm. he takes your sympathies And they start with this guy who's making the bet because this other guy is really a bore. He's a pain in the butt. And he's, you know, you want this guy to shut up. So your sympathies are with the guy who's making the bet. Yeah, get this guy to shut up. And then gradually your sympathies go to the other guy because this guy is now shit turning. He's starting to spread rumors and say things he shouldn't say. And you know, so your sympathy is turning to him. And then when the guy comes out and this guy says, I don't have the money. Well, you would think, all right, now he's clearly the villain here. He made this bet and didn't have the money, but he's sincere. He tells this guy, listen, I would have begged on the street. I would have begged on the street if I could have got you the money. I would have done anything. I wanted to get you out of there early. I couldn't do it. And I'm a fraud. And he tells the whole club, I'm a fraud. I don't deserve to be here. I'm going to resign my membership immediately. And he's repentant. I mean, you know, so you now all of a sudden, whoa, wait a second. Now your sympathies are going the other way. And then this guy says, I cheated. I cut my vocal cords. I would never have been able to spend a year being silent. I had to go to extreme means to be silent. So you sympathize with him. Oh, man, he cut his vocal cords? Wow, that's terrible. But at the same time, he cheated. He knew he couldn't do it. So it's this moral dilemma of back and forth. And neither of the characters are to blame completely or to like completely. And Serling's, the way he develops that episode is just amazing. I think that's, you know, if you talk about, you know, writing classes, you want a writing class, take that script and teach that to somebody, because it starts with the economy of language. That's the economy of language that Rod Serling was able to do, particularly in that episode, is incredible. I mean, he starts with the very first scene in the show is the boar talking his head off at these other people. And he's saying things like, you know, I was talking to so-and-so today and he gives you the name. I was talking to so-and-so and he says he'd do this and do that. And you know that name that he's dropped is a name drop. It's a fictional name. It's a mythical name. It doesn't mean anything to us watching the show, but you know it's a name drop. You know the other people saying, oh, God, now he's telling us how he's friends with the mayor again, you know, that kind of thing. And it's in two lines. You get the total sense of this character. You get the total sense of the character and the dynamic between him and the rest of the club in like 2 minutes of dialogue, if that, 2 minutes of dialogue. And then same thing with the other character, where, you know, the character who makes the bet is sitting there with this other guy saying, do you believe this guy? He's going on and he's gritting his teeth and saying, and it's just, it's an amazing bit of characterization in dialogue. You know, he's talking about how great Serling was with dialogue. Well, this was dialogue that established characteristics in every word. Not a word is wasted in that episode. And it's just, it's a clinic. It's a television writing clinic.
You mentioned the two twists there. There's a third one, which is not known necessarily to people watching the episode, but it has to do with this interesting backstory about the loudmouth boar. Do you know what I'm referring to?
His wife, you're talking about,
he gets in a bar fight.
The backstory. Yes. Well, that's actually the guy who makes the bet.
It's the guy that makes the bet.
Yeah. I forget what is the actor's name? French Otone, very good actor. Yeah, he got into a bar fight while the episode was filming. And so if you watch it now and you know that, watch particularly for the scenes where he is talking to the character in the booth, in the silent booth. When he's talking to him, he has his face pressed up against the glass. So you can only see one side of his face because the other side of his face was mangled from getting beat up. And you would never know that from watching it. But now if you know, watch it, you'll notice they never show that left, I think the left side of his face from a certain point forward in the episode.
Oh, it's amazing. You know, while you were telling that story, I watched, I had this deluxe edition of Network, which I mentioned earlier, because it's my favorite film. And it's, you know, the little extras, you get the bonus material. So you have Sidney Lumet doing the commentary, you know, while the movie's playing, and you learn all of these amazing, you know, backstories. And, oh, well, in this scene, it was raining. So when Howard Beale is walking through the streets of New York, it wasn't raining. So we had to, you know, we brought in the rain machine and all of this stuff. How cool would it have been? Because, you know, Serling died in 75, but to have him available to do the commentaries on all of those episodes.
Yeah. Well, you know, the amazing thing is that, there is some Serling commentary on some episodes in some of the DVD releases in the Blu-ray, because Rod taught for a long time. And in teaching, he would very often use his own work as examples of things. So they were able to take some of Rod's teaching audio and put it to the episodes. For example, during Walking Distance in Twilight Zone, you have Rod Serling talking about, you know, what he was thinking when he wrote, you know, this scene or whatever, and talking about Gig Young's performance in the episode and things like that. And there's a bunch like that, actually, that because he brought up his own work, you know, a lot as examples of what to do and what not to do, usually what not to do, again, because Rod was such a critic of his own work. So yeah, you do actually have that on a handful of episodes at least.
Oh, very cool. Where did he teach writing?
He taught at Ithaca College for several years from around the late 60s until he died in 75, really mid 60s until 75. And he taught at Antioch College. Actually, after we talked about, you know, there were three seasons of The Twilight Zone at a half an hour, and then it was 1 hour. Well, in between the third and fourth season, Rod Serling decided he was going to take a break, and he went back to Yellow Springs, Ohio, where he went to college. He went to Antioch, and he taught. So he taught several classes at Antioch in the interim between the third and fourth season of The Twilight Zone, and actually even during the fourth season of The Twilight Zone. And that's one reason why he wasn't quite as involved with The Twilight Zone as much in the fourth and fifth seasons as he had been previously. But so he taught there, and he loved teaching. He loved interacting with the students. It was something he was good at, and yeah, he really enjoyed it.
Wow. Can you imagine taking a writing course from Rod Serling and maybe having one of your short stories with his comments written on the margins? That's something you would frame. Let's talk about a favorite episode of many people, and it's probably on most people's top 10 list, Burgess Meredith and his most famous episode, Time Enough at Last. Tell listeners who don't know about the episode, give us a little summary, and we'll talk about that one.
Yeah, Time Enough at Last was written by Rod Serling, based on a short story by Lynn Venable, a woman who I don't think published more than half a dozen short stories in her life, I think, but this was one of them. I don't think she published many more. But, and you know what, I shouldn't even say a woman, because Lynn, I guess, could be a man. I don't even know for sure if it's a woman or a man, but anyway, Lynn Venable. And it's about a bank teller who loves to read. He loves to read. Not only does he love to read, he's obsessed with reading. He's a bibliophile. He loves to read so much that he reads at work, and he's a bank teller, and he's making mistakes because he's constantly reading and not paying attention to his job. And one of his daily rituals is to get away from his boss and the customers, he will take his lunch break in the vault, in the bank vault. So he'll go and he'll take a book and he'll go down to the vault and to get away and read. And one day he goes down to the vault to read, and there's a gigantic bang, and his glasses fall off, and he wears, you know, very thick glasses, and he stumbles out of the vault to discover that there's been a bomb has been dropped. The nuclear war has started. The bomb has been dropped on America, and he very well may be the last man on Earth. And he's stumbling through the wreckage, finding his coworkers and his boss and everybody else. And the only thing that saved him was being in the bank vault. And you follow him through the episode, you know, as he's searching for food and, you know, it's kind of scavenging, searching for it to see if there's anybody still alive, and gradually becoming more despondent, you know, realizing that he very well may be the last person on Earth. And he finds a sporting goods store with a gun, and he finds a gun, and he finally decides, I'm gonna end things. I'm gonna, you know, God wouldn't want me to be like you. God wouldn't hold it against me if I ended my life right now. But now, because there's nothing to live for. And the moment he's going to pull the trigger, he sees in the distance the public library. And the public library had been destroyed, but of course the books are all there. And so he goes crazy. He goes, oh, I have all the books. I have all the books that I can read, all the books I could ever want. He's going to set them up. I'm going to read these in January, and these in February, and these in March. And he sets them all up on the steps, and he sits down to read that first book. And I have time enough at last to read books. And he bends over to read the first book, and his glasses fall off and break on the concrete. And he's so blind, you see, that, you know, he can't read. He can't read a word. And he's completely, he might as well be blind. And it's an ending that's a punch in the gut. I mean, it's just, you know, I get goosebumps telling you about it. Like, I've seen it 50 times, you know. It's a punch in the gut, because at least as far as I'm concerned, this is the character in Twilight Zone history that did not deserve what he got. All he wanted to do was read, and this comes along, and Burgess Meredith's last lines are, it's not fair. It's not fair at all. He's crying, and he's saying, it's not fair. And that's what you feel as a viewer. I felt, I mean, you feel, this is not fair. This is not poetic justice. This is maybe poetic, but it ain't justice. This is injustice, you know? And it's one of the most famous twist endings in Twilight Zone history. And that is the twist ending from the short story, by the way. I mean, Rod didn't come up with that. That was the twist ending. So it's a terrific ending. And, you know, Rod saw it that way. In the book, I quote from a letter that he responded to. Somebody had written to tell him how cruel that ending was. And he agreed. agrees. He says, yeah, you know, we were going for irony, but we kind of came across as sadism. It was really pretty cruel, you know. But the amazing thing is years and years and years after seeing this episode 20 times and always thinking that that was the only possible interpretation of that episode, I've heard from people who say, no, he got exactly what he deserved because he wanted to be estranged from people. He wanted, all he wanted to do was read. He didn't want to be around people. He wanted to deal with people. He didn't want to interact with people. He just wanted to read, and he blew off the humanity for his whole life. And now he's going to have to live without humanity because, you know, he had to go read, and now they're all taken away from him. He's going to get his just desserts. And nice as that may sound, I think it's nonsense. I think it's bull. There's no way. There's no way. Because I think for what's on the screen, if you really see what's on the screen, it's not that he wants to get away and read. He's constantly trying to share his love of books with people, with his wife, who's one of the worst characters in Twilight Zone history. She tears the pages out of his books and, you know, scribbles on the pages. I mean, but he tries to share his love of reading with his wife. He wants to read poetry to her. He tells her, oh, there's some beautiful things in here. Let me read this to you. Or he tells his boss, have you ever read David Copperfield? I want to tell you about the character. You know, there's this pet character in there. You know, that's amazing. And so it was never totally an internal thing with him. And it wasn't like he was just talking to these people, like talking down at them, saying how much I love this book. And, you know, he wanted to share it with them. He wanted to dialogue. He wanted the dialogue. So I think he was always yearning for human companionship. It was just that in this world, and by this world, I mean the world of that episode, not necessarily the world we live in. I think that, and this is a point I make in the book, I think that that world of that episode is not necessarily our world, even before the bomb drops. I think before the bomb drops, that world is a dystopia. It's a world where intelligence is frowned upon and shunned. It's a world where the word reader, is an epithet. I mean, his boss calls him, you are a reader. Like, it's the worst thing in the world, you know, it's an epithet. Yeah, it's a pejorative. I mean, his wife is a terrible, terrible woman who, you know, thinks that reading all literature is doggerel. I mean, so this is a world that really hates the written word and hates literature, I think. And so he was living in that world. And so that's, he found himself to be the only one who had this love of words, and he wanted to share it with people. And there was no way to share it in this particular, you know, setting.
Maybe that's one that Rod Serling, if he could have, he would have taken that back and maybe did a rewrite. A favorite non Rod Serling episode for you, would it be the Howling Man?
Yes, I think that would probably be my top. Yeah. For a long time, that was probably my favorite episode, period, actually. And over the years, it's kind of slipped a little bit, but I still love it. Yeah, that's probably my favorite. Yeah.
So tell us about the episode. What happens?
Howling Man is written by Charles Beaumont, based on his short story. And it's about a man on a walking trip through Europe during World War II and before World War II. And he gets lost in a storm, and he stops at a castle or a monastery for help, for shelter from the storm. He just wants to stay for a little while, and they try to turn him away. No, you can't stay here. And, you know, why can't I stay here? I just want some food. Just give me a night, and they can't stay here. Well, it turns out that the brothers there believe that they have locked up the devil. They caught the devil, and they've have him locked up in a cell. And of course, they don't want anybody to know about it. Certainly not somebody who just walked in off the street. And he, they tell him to stay away from the door. Don't listen to him howling. He's going to howl. He's going to try to get out. Just don't pay attention to him. And despite all the warnings, he doesn't believe them. And he lets the man, who he thinks is just a man, out. And the man turns into the devil. And he is the devil. And he escapes. And so for the rest of this man's life, he's going to dedicate himself to recapture, to making up for what he did. He's going to recapture the devil. And the end of the episode, he shows that, yes, he did. He recaptured him, and he has to go out to call Brother Jerome to bring him back. But he has a maid there. Don't go near the door. And of course, the maid goes to the door and lets him out again. Yeah. So, and the catch at the end of the episode, the closing narration is, you can catch the devil, but you can't hold him long. So I always loved that episode, the visuals of it, the direction of it. It's a scary episode. It's a great one.
Where does, on your list of top 10, or maybe it's not in your top 10, I don't know, I don't want to be presumptuous here, Terror at 20,000 Feet with William Shatner?
I usually put that maybe just outside my top 10, somewhere like 11, 12, somewhere in there. Yeah, it's a great episode. Shatner is great in it. I defend William Shatner to the end. You know, if anybody thinks William Shatner overacts, he's a bad actor, watch Nightmare 20,000 Feet. He's a great performance and an understated performance, especially compared to John Lithgow in the movie version of it. Yeah. So yeah, I put that just right outside my top 10, bro.
This is Richard Matheson's episode, right?
Yes. Yep. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Just give us briefly a summary. What happens?
That's Bob Wilson is William Shatner's character's name. Bob Wilson is flying home with his wife from a mental institution. He had been in an asylum. He had a nervous breakdown. I shouldn't say an asylum, but he had a nervous breakdown, and he was in an institution for a while. And his nervous breakdown occurred on an airplane. And he's flying home from that with his wife, and he looks out the window and he sees a creature on the wing of the plane. And of course, in true Twilight Zone fashion, he's the only one who can see the creature. Every time anybody else looks out the window, the creature has floated away or jumped away, and he can't convince anybody that there's a creature on the wing of the plane. But he has to trust his own senses. He has to trust that, yeah, I'm not going crazy. I'm not losing it. There is a creature out there. And he's able to steal a gun from a security officer on the plane, opens the hatch and starts shooting at the gremlin, and the plane is able to land through the storm and everything else. And again, they think he's crazy. He's in a straitjacket, and he says he's okay. And he says, "Yeah, I know I'm okay. I'm the only one who does know right now." And then they pan up to the wing of the plane, and you see the wing of the plane has been clawed up, and it's torn up the planks, you know. So something, you know, lightning didn't do that. Something did. So soon enough, they're going to realize that he was right, that there was something on the plane.
Shatner's castmate on Star Trek, George Takei, Sulu, Mr. Sulu on Star Trek, he appeared in an episode called The Encounter, and I haven't seen it, and I don't know whether it's because it wasn't included in the syndication but what is so controversial about this episode, The Encounter?
Well, today, probably not too much, but at the time, it was considered controversial. And yes, it was not included in the initial syndication package, so it was not seen for like 25 years after it aired. And what was controversial about it was it's a good episode. It's about George Takei plays a gardener. He's a gardener for this man, and he's on the grounds, and this guy is cleaning out his attic, and George Takei goes up to meet this guy in the attic to talk about the yard or whatever it may be. And the guy has a samurai sword there, and they start talking about the samurai sword. And it turns out that the guy says that he got the samurai sword during World War II. He killed a Japanese soldier, and he took the samurai sword from him. And George Takei admits that, during World War II, his family had helped to guide the planes into Pearl Harbor. That they were in Honolulu, they were in Hawaii, and they helped to guide the planes to their targets. And many Asian American groups, of course, said, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, whoa! There is no evidence whatsoever that any Asian American was a spy, you know, that aided the Japanese in the attack." And to insinuate that is really problematic. And I would agree. Even in a fictional setting, that's not not a good message to be sending. So after the complaints, the episode was just it wasn't aired again, and they just held that as syndication. And now you can find it on, obviously, the DVD collections and things like that. It's a pretty good episode.
How did Rod Serling make out? He owned half of the show. With syndication, I mean, he should have been set for life.
You would think so, yeah. And he would have been if he hadn't sold his rights to the show back to CBS. This is probably the worst decision of Rod Serling's life. It's unfortunate. I mean, but what Rod Serling did was, he owned half the show. He had half the films, you know, he owned 50% right of the films and everything else. And Rod, after the show went off the air, he was very impatient with how long it took to get into syndication. One of the things, again, I think this is a misconception. I think people say, oh, he didn't know how much it would be worth, and he didn't know about syndication, and he didn't know about merchandising. And none of that's really true. He did know. But he was upset that, this is in letters, this is, you know, I've read, you know, his correspondence. He was upset that shows that lasted not as long as The Twilight Zone and ended their runs after The Twilight Zone were already in syndication making money, and The Twilight Zone was sitting there collecting dust. And why am I not getting my residual? Why isn't this in syndication? And he was upset. So he finally just said, screw it. And he didn't want to fight with him anymore. And he sold his interest back to CBS. And he sold his interest back to CBS for roughly $700,000 or $800,000. Now in 1965, $800,000 is probably about $8 million today. So it wasn't peanuts. I mean, it was a nice chunk of change, but it's worth 100 times that now. I mean, if he'd held on to it, his great 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 grandchildren would have been set for life, you know. And as it was, he was set, and his kids were set. But that's pretty much probably about it.
Rod Serling. His Life, Work, and Imagination. That's the book. Nicholas Parisi. And again, Serling Fest 2022 coming to Binghamton, New York in August. Go to serlingfest2022.com. And Nicholas, what a pleasure hanging out with you for the last two hours. I learned a lot.
Same here, Richard. Thanks so much. I had a great time.
All right, that's it for me. My thanks to Carlos and Ryan. Back next week with a brand new program. Hope you'll be along for the ride. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed. Nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.